You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of September 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, pack your bags, kids, we're moving to Mars. We'll look at today's exciting news from NASA about water on the red planet. Also ahead, tensions between the US and Russia come face to face today, with Vladimir Putin sitting down opposite Barack Obama. What's likely to make the agenda? I'll ask my studio guests, Ramita Navai and also Martin Sanbu. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Ohio governor isn't pulling punches when discussing some of his more divisive colleagues.
It's about inexperience. I mean, the people who keep saying that they want things to happen, what have they accomplished? What have they gotten done? They're serving in the Congress. Have they accomplished anything?
John Kasich is one of the many Republicans lining up to lambast party insiders who were happy to see the back of the outgoing speaker. We'll look at how it's all affecting the increasingly bizarre race to the White House. Plus, is Catalonia really about to declare independence from Spain? And 42 years after it first took flight, is it time we reassess the virtues of flying Concorde? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today are Ramita Navai, freelance foreign affairs journalist and the author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death and the Search for Truth in Tehran. And also Martin Sanbu, economics writer for the Financial Times. Welcome both to the programme. Now, in an exciting day for Sky Watchers, there's been the confirmation of what once seemed like something out of an atomic era of science fiction. At long last, researchers at NASA have confirmed the existence of water on Mars. Liquid water is said to cascade down the planet's canyons and crater walls during the summer months. Martin, is this a story you watch with excitement, and how important do you think this is?
Oh, I think it's fantastically exciting. I mean, I was one of those kids who dreamed about space and how we would all be going there and so on. And I suppose I'm just old enough to have caught the kind of tail end of the excitement that came after the 60s and 70s. Not old enough to remember that, but the excitement was sort of still there. And then you had the Challenger disaster and just lack of funding, and the Cold War stopped, so nobody wanted to put money into these things anymore. And so it all sort of died. I think it's very exciting that we're sending things out there again. And water on Mars, you know, of course, people who are not experts like myself, I immediately think, well, water, that must mean life, and life, that must mean conscious life, and so on. And that's the really exciting prospect here. Of course, that's not what they're talking about, but it's a good start.
But I guess, Ramita, that is what NASA are saying as well. If there is water, there is the potential that there is some form of life on the planet. But I guess that begins to throw up all sorts of, you know, important questions. Like, if there is life there, does sending any probe from Earth begin to risk, you know, infecting what life there is there? Suddenly we have a bit of a kind of moral responsibility. We're not just kind of nosing around the neighbourhood. We're coming with potentially kind of danger in our wake as well.
Of course, as we always do. I'm waiting for first contact. I think this is really exciting. And of course, I get really disappointed whenever anything like this happens. At first, it's the most exciting news. And then you realise that it's, you know, it's not even an amoeba, which, you know, an amoeba means life, is absolutely exciting. But for some reason, I'm waiting for a sentient being to step out on the planet, which, of course, is not going to happen.
It's the aliens we want.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I've got a horrible feeling this whole thing has been done to promote a certain Matt Damon film. But tell me, when you see these images, I think that's the extraordinary thing, is, you know, that we've moved into a world where whatever we think of, we see in such clarity. The images that they've been showing today of the red planet are kind of amazing. And as you say, I think they kind of take you back to those early days of when it was exciting to think about space travel. You suddenly see this other planet in a way that, you know, we just have never really kind of understood it.
Yes and no, right? Because it's true, we see these amazing things. But I think most of us kind of recognize them from you know, science fiction and our imagination and so on. But so many of us have either grown up with this or read about this, and it's almost like we recognize what we had already seen. It's a bit like coming to New York, and you, of course, you recognize yellow cabs, even if you've never been there before. It's just such part of our kind of collective imagination.
But also, what is extraordinary is, you know, we've seen so many, you know, science fiction films, and this idea of kind of like traveling much further out into the galaxy and galaxies beyond, it suddenly makes you realize also there are quite limitations of what we're able to do. We've managed to get to the next planet, and even then, what we do on that planet is kind of curtailed. You know, before we move on, Ramita, without getting too big about these issues at the top of the show, do you think that does give you some sense of our smallness in all of these, in all of the things that we see around us every day? That suddenly, when you see something like this, you realise we are but a speck.
Absolutely. As my granddad used to say, you are but a pip in the universe. I think he meant speck, and it's bad translating. But the timing of this as well is quite extraordinary. I don't know if you guys were up watching The Blood Moon last night.
I was.
But for this to have happened after watching that extraordinary sight, you do have a sense of your own insignificance, absolutely. And a sense as well that of all the possibilities out there, maybe there are hundreds of worlds, who knows?
Well, a kind of glorious and unusual start to Midori House. We're not normally in the world of science, and we're going to move back to slightly more familiar territory now, because the US and Russia have never been the kind of friends to enjoy a cozy dinner together. But in a rare sign that increased cooperation could be on the horizon, Barack Obama is meeting with Vladimir Putin for a closed-door discussion at the UN General Assembly today. Among the common concerns to be discussed is Syria. The US seems to have conceded that if it comes to choosing between Bashar al-Assad and the so-called Islamic State, the Syrian president is likely to win out. Martin, it's kind of terribly tragic that we've been through so many machinations and so many attempts to dislodge Bashar al-Assad, and we're seeing from European leaders and as well as the US are now kind of a backing away from this notion that it's, you know, he has to go before there can be any negotiated deal. Do you think that we are beginning to see a horrible kind of new politics come to the fore, where we kind of forget all the things that we were thinking over the last 3 or 4 years about Arab Springs and the rise of democracy in Syria?
Yeah, I'm not sure everyone was so clear that Assad had to go. I think if there had been more clarity among more people on that point, maybe at least the West could have kind of got behind a strategy of trying to make that happen. Part of the problem, in my view, was that nobody wanted to deal with Assad because of how tainted he quite clearly is, and Obama still says this. But there was also no appetite for actually doing anything, taking the consequence of that. So the West left it pretty much to unequipped, underarmed, underhelped rebels who didn't manage to do very much and are still being hammered and slaughtered by Assad, and that is part of what left the space for IS to come up.
Ramita, is it just kind of reality that we accept that he's going to stay potentially now, or do you feel that the West is choosing the wrong narrative here?
I think these talks between Putin and Obama will be really interesting, because Obama today said in his talk at the UN that he cannot see a Syria with Assad. Of course, we've heard Putin, who has said that Assad must stay, will stay. So this is going to be really interesting how it plays out. And we mustn't forget, I think, as well, what you were saying, Martin, that there was no appetite to dislodge Assad. Also, I think, in part, because the West were very aware that he was being propped up by Iran, and they didn't want to stir the hornet's nest. So now Russia is really changing the game here and is really undermining America. And America's strategy has not worked. So as you said, you know, they have been arming rebels. They started arming rebels way too late. So for Assad, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. At first, it was quite a pure uprising. They weren't terrorists. Most of the rebels now are part of some kind of extremist group. So it's going to be really interesting to see what America does, because their policy has not worked. And I think they're going to have to edge towards negotiations with Assad. I think that will happen.
Martin, how brutal, when you look at the timing of this, I'm sure, of course, discussion has been going on for a long time, but how convenient. We've had a summer when European nations have had to deal with a migration crisis that's off the charts because of what's happening in Syria, and they don't like it and they're scared of their electorates and they would like to see some resolution. Then all of a sudden they're giving up on all these things that are told us were crucial to any kind of deal. For example, the disappearance of Mr. Assad. Now they're saying, fine, potentially he stays. We kind of come to some kind of peace deal that will surely stop the outflow of people from what remains of Syria, and even the people on the neighbouring camps could potentially start to go home. Is this kind of some kind of grim deal that's being done by European nations thinking, we want the migration crisis stop, please. Okay, well, now we'll deal with Assad.
I think it does reflect the extraordinary short-sightedness of European policy in the last couple of years. This refugee crisis is in large part caused by the crisis in Syria. It's been made worse because Europe and the US have cut funding for some of the humanitarian aid in the neighbouring areas where a lot of the refugees, most of the refugees actually are. That's part of why more of them have found, even being outside of Syria, but in Turkey and Jordan and so on, being intolerable enough that it will try to make it to Europe. So there are a number of mistakes. One is to not be serious about trying to make progress in Syria itself on the war. The other thing is not to take the refugee problem seriously when it didn't actually affect us directly on European shores. So I think there's a bit of a scramble now to try to find something, anything that will work. Will it? Well, I think I have more hope in what the Americans can maybe try to come up with, given, I'd like to hear Ramita's view on this, given the what looks like a deal with Iran, how does that change the grand politics in Syria?
How does it change the deal? What is the card being played here by Iran, could be played by Iran?
Well, so it's interesting. Iran and Russia have always had an alliance. So I think you can't now talk about Iran within the Middle Eastern continents without talking about Russia. Because, of course, Putin is flexing his muscles with, nearly 1,700 troops. He sent there with warplanes, with weapons in the port of Latakia in Syria. He really wants to muscle in on Middle Eastern geopolitics. He has lost his... Russia has lost its sense of usefulness now that Iran has come to an agreement, nuclear agreement, because Russia is no longer an intermediary between the West and Iran. With falling oil prices, Russia now is looking to expand its two major exports, nuclear technology and weapons that it is already selling to Iran. The Saudis are currently talking to Assad about deals. So I think Russia and Iran are forming a really interesting alliance. And of course, recently, last two days, it was announced, the Iraqis announced that Russia, Iraq and Iran are sharing intelligence over ISIS. So Russia is really starting to prove itself a major player and really starting to fight back at its own isolation due to sanctions.
But I also think that Putin's been, has he been any more complicated than any other kind of world leader? So yes, he has put troops on the ground. He is backing the Assad regime. We're kind of doing the same in our own kind of like feeble way. We're sending planes up to back the people that we would like to support. We're doing drone attacks. We're sharing intelligence. So it's not like we're not there. It's just that actually maybe he's kind of has a bit more guts to put people on the ground, which we're kind of cautious of doing. And in the West, I wonder that it's interesting seeing on US television. It's interesting seeing he has gone to the US. And he's happy to be on a global stage because I think he's found a kind of sweet spot here. He can say to people, look, I'm the most vehemently opposed to ISIS, more than any of your governments, any of the people that you think of as democratically elected. I'm doing something about it. I'm risking our guys' lives. I'm putting 1,700 people on the ground. I can turn the narrative. What do you want? Do you want ISIS? Or do you want a dictator you don't particularly like, but who can actually run a secular country that's safe and sound? And I think that actually, if you ask people on the street in Paris or in London or New York, actually, they're probably going to back Mr. Putin's view, don't you think?
Well, there's also the people on the streets in Moscow and elsewhere in Russia. That's where one of Putin's advantages lie, I think, that he has a more favourable
But I think if you go out on the street here and if you walk over to Edgware Road and you say to like, all the people there who are displaced from, you know, the Middle East or who have friends in the region, actually, you don't like what's going on there. You don't like President Assad. But what do you want? Do you want your families to be able to go back home to Aleppo to rebuild their businesses, to reopen their factories? Or do you want them to live a life of exile, you know, bobbing around in boats, you know, trying to get to Kos? And I think these people will say, actually, we don't like it. But actually, Mr. Putin's got a point here. We will back him.
I think you're quite right. I think Syrian refugees have long wanted intervention, maybe ideally from the West, but I'm sure they'll take it from Russia to... But they also want to get rid of Assad. They keep saying that, right? That doing a deal with Assad is not going to work. I don't know who is right. I would just also add that for Putin, there's something a bit situational here. You know, make yourself a force to be reckoned with in Syria. Require, force almost Obama to talk to you because you have to be reckoned with. What can you ask in return? We help you in Syria. Well, what's going to happen in Ukraine? There are dark speculations out there that what Putin is really aiming for is some sort of quid pro quo where he gets, you know, he basically gets to consolidate his gain in Ukraine.
Ramita, you know the region far better than I do. Do you think that there would be a constituency of people who have been displaced who will actually say, okay, I hate the regime of Assad, but actually, if it stops the destruction of what remains of my country, then I will back what Putin is doing?
Yes, but certainly not the rebels. And when I say rebels, I also mean ordinary Syrians who have joined rebel factions. And what's interesting, and I just spent quite a lot of time in Lebanon, and I spoke to a lot of Syrians there. This is really interesting, that there are a lot of Syrians that have joined ISIS simply because they think that's their best bet to topple Assad. They are not ideologically Islamically fundamental in any way. So I think, yes, there's a large part of the Syrian population that will be okay with negotiating with Assad. They simply want to go home. But there's also a large part that's going to fight it until the very bitter end.
And just on that, you know, obviously, you know, when you look at any map now, the carving up of Syria, you look at, you know, the Kurdish territory in the north. The Kurds have that territory. They have it nice and firm, the same as the territory they have in Iraq. Even if, you know, if Assad, you know, comes to the head of some kind of, you know, new government, he's not going to take control of the country in the same way he used to have, is he?
Absolutely not. I think what will happen if there isn't general agreement to start negotiating with Assad will be slowly to take power away from Assad. So it will be basically how, for the next step, who is going to be the next leader of the country. That will be agreed by countries like Iran and Russia, as we saw in Iraq.
Well, we're going to stay in the US and kind of stay with politics and stay with a bit of kind of blood on the floor as well. Because as things stand now, the top three candidates to become the Republican presidential nominee are a former CEO, a neurosurgeon, and Mr. Donald Trump. Yet, despite the polls, many influential voices hold firm that soon enough everything will go back to normal and Jeb Bush will emerge from the bickering that surrounds him to battle it out against Hillary Clinton. But it's becoming increasingly clear that in this election, the normal rules do not apply. Last week saw two surprise Republican casualties. Scott Walker ended his campaign and the House Speaker, John Boehner, resigned, with deep splintering inside the GOP only intensifying. Is all the noise preventing the Republican Party from demonstrating what it actually stands for? Well, speaking on CBS's network Face the Nation on Sunday, the outgoing Speaker, John Boehner, had some pretty tough words for his Republican colleagues. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
I mean, this whole idea that we're going to shut down the government to get rid of Obamacare in 2013, this plan never had a chance. But over the course of the August recess in 2013 and the course of September, you know, a lot of my Republican colleagues who knew it was a fool's errand, really, they were getting all this pressure from home to do this. And so we got groups here in town, members of the House and Senate here in town, who whip people into a frenzy believing they can accomplish things that they know are never going to happen.
Well, John Boehner was leading a House which had the largest Republican majority since Herbert Hoover was president, yet he found it impossible to drum enough support up to push real progress on core party issues. What does this say about the state of the party? What does it say about the state of the party, Martin?
Well, I think Boehner's resignation is probably best seen as a desperate cry for help from the reality-based wing of the Republican Party. There are some serious politicians in the Republican Party who have, of course, huge policy differences with the Democrats and with President Obama, but who would kind of like to get some of those policies resolved in their favor. That's not what the Republican Party has managed to do ever since it rose back in prominence in the House and in the Senate. So Boehner was, you know, not a centrist, but he was trying to get people to actually vote things through. On some occasions, he had to do that with Democratic support rather than his own right wing. In the long run, that's untenable. I think that's why he resigned.
Just explain to our listeners, what was it that about him that really kind of irked many of the people in his party? Why was he forced out? What was unpopular about him?
Well, I think it was the relative pragmatism, because you have the Tea Party contingent who are, I think, much more concerned with, some call it political purity, to stand for the issues they believe are right, even if that means sending the government to a shutdown, not being able to pass anything. Remember that the American political system is designed to make it very hard to do anything. That's what the founding fathers wanted. They were afraid of tyranny. So unless you can get a solid majority behind something, it won't pass, and the result is gridlock. Now, the Tea Party and that part of the Republican Party, they're not interested in compromise. They have a very shrill vision of what they want, and they are numerous, but they're not a majority, and they probably never will be. So you see that both in Congress, gridlock in Congress, but you also see it in the Republican primary process, where you have several of these characters appealing to that group, which is large within the Republican Party, but not large enough to actually win a general election.
Ramita, it does seem to be one of these things that happens around the world when you have, you know, a party which has to listen to very vociferous voices, you know, amongst its supporters. The Tea Party, you know, very good at bending the ear of, you know, of its representatives, and trying to get them thrown out if it doesn't like what they're up to. But in the end, you know, as Ben has said, it's actually just very, very difficult then to get the, you know, to do what these people are asking, because it's impossible. And then you look stupid when you kind of fail to kind of like dislodge Obamacare, for example.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting, what's going on here is that, and I think it shows a real movement that's spreading from, you know, America to Europe, is that the main faces, the main Republican, three Republican candidates are new faces. And I think this is this movement towards change. I think people want change. And I think people are fed up of hereditary power. And that's why at the moment we're not hearing so much about Clinton and Bush, and it is all these kind of new names.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Ramita Navai and Martin Sanbu. Coming up next, is Catalonia really about to declare independence? And it's been 42 years since the Concorde took its first flight. Is it time we reassessed the supersonic jet?
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ramita Navai and Martin Sanbu. Now, the concept of an independent Catalan state has been bubbling on the back burner for a while now. International press hasn't given the idea a great deal of credence, and the Spanish Prime Minister rejects the proposal as nonsense. But the weekend's election in Catalonia gave the region's pro-independence parties what they say is a clear mandate to form an independent Catalan state. Spain's economy has been gripped by austerity measures now for some time, but is ceding really a way out of that? Martin, you know, we've it's an interesting time in Europe. You know, there's lots of areas and territories which seem to be straining at the leash of their kind of, you know, their centralist governments. We've seen, you know, Scotland have a choice, but in the end narrowly decide to stay within the union in the UK. We look around Europe, lots of kind of more federal kind of situations. Is it good, do you think, for countries to break up?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between whether countries could be different from what they are. Could Catalonia be independent? Could Scotland be independent and be successful and thrive? And the answer to that is generally yes. It's kind of arbitrary history that makes nations what they happen to be today. But that's not the same as saying that the breakup would be straightforward. Any breakup, I think, would be quite complicated, partly because of the emotional issues involved and the terrible politics you would get as a result. In time, things would probably work out. And this sort of encasement of the European Union means that, you know, a lot of rules and laws would be similar anyway. Now, I have no idea whether Catalonia will end up being independent. Could it survive independently? I'm sure it could. I don't have an opinion on whether it's a good idea. But notice that it's a pretty, while it probably has ancient roots, it's a pretty recent movement, this independence movement. There was an attempt at extending regional autonomy just a few years ago, 2010, I think. It was struck down by the Supreme Court. That's sort of what triggered the failure of accommodating more autonomy, is what triggered a lot of the support, the broader support for the independence movement. So some of this is a story of kind of unintended consequences of people maybe cracking down too harshly on people who wanted a little bit more autonomy and then sending them into an independence camp. And you can tell the same story about Scotland.
Ramita, it's kind of amazing when you think, you always imagine Europe to be quite a stable place. But when you just look at the countries that have been created in like the last 20 years, you know, a united Germany, the fracturing of the former Yugoslavia, you know, it's a very kind of changing landscape. And, you know, not always kind of coming together, a lot of pulling apart. Again, do you think Catalonia will go its own separate way?
Well, if you look at the figures, it's really interesting. 5 years ago, about 25% of the population supported independence. Now it's one in every two Catalans support it. So there is a growing pro-separatist movement. And if this trend continues, it'd be really interesting to see what happens at the polls. And also, I think it's really interesting to look at Scotland and look at what's happening now. Because, of course, in Scotland, the turnout was huge for the Scottish vote. And that really propelled, that was real kind of forward momentum for the general elections, because the Scots that turned out for the general elections turned out in much higher number than the previous election. And that's what everybody is saying will happen in Catalonia.
I think we should just add that this overlaps the other phenomenon we touched on before, this anti-elite insurrection politics.
Yeah.
In Scotland, part of the SNP vote was an anti-Tory vote. In Catalonia, a lot of the vote was an anti-established party vote. And you saw these new parties, even though they're against independence, also do well.
But it's kind of extraordinary. You look at Switzerland, you know, a country which is half speaks French, you know, half speaks, you know, German, and there's, of course, Italian and Romansh, but they still hold together. You know, it's not always cultural differences that pull people apart. It's not even being wealthy. You know, Bavaria wants to stay within Germany. So a complicated pattern, but we'll see what happens over the coming weeks. Now, I haven't left much time for this final story, but there has been discussion that Concorde could come back. Some people want to see it back on our runways and at our airport terminals once again. Does the I'll start with you this time, Ramita. Would you like to fly Concorde again? Would you like to see the return of supersonic flight?
Yes, with champagne and bloody caviar, just like the supermodels in the 90s. If it was good enough for them, good enough for me.
Absolutely. Well, I know our editor-in-chief in the good old days went on it a few times. Martin, would you be purchasing a ticket? It was extraordinary that, you know, it is one of those things where you go backwards in how technology works. You know, it now takes longer to fly to New York than it did 20 years ago.
I was devastated when they shut it down. I always dreamed of one day doing it, and then they shut the whole thing down.
Yeah.
But you're quite right. It was a defeat for the spirit of human innovation. You know, what we do as humans is to innovate and invent and improve, and now we go back. And so air travel is as bad as it was 40, 50 years ago.
Well,
I really hope they bring it back.
Yeah, me too. I think, as I say, it was always weird when technology goes in the wrong direction. It's 42 years since it first took flight. And as I said, I think a few people in this building had go on it at some time or other. But we're going to have to leave it there for this week. And that's a nice story that ties with back of the show. That sense of adventure, technology can take us places. I'm not sure the Concorde could actually go all the way to the red planet, but you never know. But Ramita Navai and Martin Sambu, thank you very much for joining me on Midori House today. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Federico Romaniello. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli is going to be bringing you lots of music from our rather glorious playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. And at 2200 hours, well, of course, it's The Monocle Daily. The show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow. When else? At 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening. And goodbye.